So tonight we're going to do a little bit. We're going to do some things on the parasha, and then we'll talk. Have a Rosh Hashanah thought. So we're going to start on page 1086. We'll start from the beginning of the parasha. You are standing today, all of you, before Hashem your God. The heads of your tribes, your elders, your officers, Kolish Yisrael, every Jewish man, your children, your wives, and the ger, the gercha, the convert that is in your midst, from those who chop your wood to those who draw your water, for you to pass into the covenant of Hashem your God and into his oath, that Hashem your God is making that bris, that covenant with you today. In order to establish you today for him as a nation, and he shall be for you as God, as he has spoken to you. And as he has sworn to your forefathers, to Abraham, Yitzchak, and to Yaakov. And not with you alone, am I making this covenant with you, and this oath with you, rather, with the ones that are here with us today in front of Hashem, our God, and with those that are not here with us today. So in this pasuk, Moshe is on the Jewish people. Hashem is creating a covenant with you, and the covenant is with those that are here today and with those that are not here today. Now, what does it mean? What are we referring to when we talk about, when the pasuk says, those who are not with us today? What is that referring to? So Rashi says that is referring to the Eis Asher Einenu. This is Rashi, Pasuk Yudalid. Who are those that are not with us? So Rashi says, this is the Rashi in the left column in the middle. V'af imedoyres ha'asidim liyos. This is also with the future generations. The covenant being made today is being made with the present generation. That's those who are here with us today. When the Pasuk says those who are not here with us today, that's referring to future generations. This covenant is being made with present generations and with the future generations. It's including all generations of the Jewish people. Now, the commentary of the Simchat Chachamim explains, he points out the following. He says, first of all, maybe we're talking about, when we talk, Rashi says we're talking about the future generations. What else could it have possibly have meant when we say the covenant is being made today with those who are here and with those who aren't here? What other explanation could have there been to those who are not here?
The past generation.
Okay. What else? So he says, the Tzivzah Chachamim is bothered. Why don't we say that those who are not here today means people who just aren't present today? You know, they're kind of out of town. They're on a trip. They're just not around. You know, and the covenant includes those who are here and those who aren't here. Now, maybe you'll say, because where would the Jewish people in the desert go? You know, the way he says it is he says, well, he said, one explanation he gives as to why it couldn't mean that is, Ein shayach lichreis bris misha einoi pay. You can't make a covenant with someone who's not here. You can't include him in a covenant. Maybe if he'd be here, he'd say, I'm not interested. But if it's going to the future generations, right, which means you've got to be able to say that even though they're not here, you can include them in a covenant. Then it could still work out. Because even if the bodies are not physically there, the explanation would be that all the neshamas were present, all the neshamas of the Jewish people, all the neshamas that are present, all future neshamas, all the neshamas of the Jewish people that would ever be were present at this point, and they accepted the covenant.
But I didn't understand the part about they're not interested.
Excuse me?
I didn't understand the part about they're not interested if they're not there.
To talk about, to say that the bris, the covenant, would have included someone who isn't present.
But what's the difference between somebody who's out of town and somebody who hasn't born yet?
Because if he's out of town, his neshama's not there either.
Oh, really?
I don't know. I would hope his neshama's with him.
Oh, I see. The new ones are not there.
Okay. But here, he's saying, but future neshamas were present. Right. Meaning, we'd be saying there was something unique going on that all the neshamas of the Jewish people that would ever be were present at this making of the covenant, and those neshamas accepted. That would be one explanation. Okay. Then he says another explanation. The Eid Yeshleimah, another explanation would be, Ki bara kari davuahu. Bar is a term that means a son, a child, is the foot of a father. It's an extension of the father. The kevin shavetz kiblu, and once the fathers have accepted, habonim abayim achareim gam kim b'chlal abris. The children who follow afterwards are also included in the covenant. So a second explanation is, again, if the traveler is not here, it's not here. But when we're talking about children, being that children are an extension of their parents, therefore, if the parent accepts, it will pass on to the children. And the truth is, we can understand that, you know, no matter how far generations go down, our genes pass on. There's always a connection to our ancestors, to whom we came from. And that connection would allow the fact that the covenant that was accepted by the ancestor should pass on to the children, to the descendants. Now, I'm a little bit bothered by this explanation because, you know, again, halachically, I believe, I could be wrong, but I believe, you know, if I decide to take something upon myself, and I have my son in mind, can I force him into something that I accepted upon myself because, well, he's an extension of me? I don't think halachically that works. So I'm not sure exact. So again, if you take the term, take the word of the Sifsei Chachamim, a son is an extension of the father, you know, if we just take that as is, you know, I'm not sure exactly how that's going to work. It's because the father's accepted it and automatically they can put it on to the children, future descendants. I'm not sure. But there's another explanation to what this could mean as to why. Meaning, the basic question is, if the people, whoever, the Pasuk is saying that the covenant, the bris, includes even people who aren't present. Well, how could that work? If they're not present, then how did they ever accept the covenant? And as he said before about the traveler, maybe they would have said they don't want. How can you go ahead and force a covenant onto someone that's not there? So the other explanation to this would be, and this explanation I saw in the Shiurim from Rabbi Yisrael Reisman of the Reshivan Tarvadas in New York. And he says that the way to understand how you can make a covenant or include in the covenant someone who's not there, because this bris that was made was not made with individuals. It was made with the Jewish people as a whole. And when you talk about a tzibur, a community, and you talk about the extended tzibur, the extended community of the Jewish people as a nation, Klal Yisrael is an entity of Klal Yisrael. It's not just a bunch of individuals together. It's an entity unto its own. And that entity never changes. That entity is eternal. Those who make up that entity, those who are part of that entity, I mean, the entity has to have individuals to make it up. Those individuals who make up that cloud, who are part of that entity, they change, right? As generations go on, they change. But the entity of Klal Yisrael always remains. And therefore, if this covenant was a covenant with the entity of Klal Yisrael, so it's a covenant on the entity. And then whoever becomes part of that entity is included into it. It would be a bris, it would be a covenant on individuals, so how do you force individual into it? But it's not about individuals here. It's about Klal Yisrael. It's about the entity of Klal Yisrael. That entity is the same entity. who now is part of an entity, that changes. But the entity is always the same. And therefore, if the oath was made with this entity, it goes on whoever is included in that entity.
I almost thought I had a question whether the number of nishomas the same, remains the same? Or
there is a concept that there is a specific number of nishomas of Klal Yisrael. Now again, you know, we can, you know, I can't tell you, I know a lot about this stuff, but you know, nishamas, we know, come back, and we have sparks of nishamas, we have parts of nishamas, you know, but there is a concept of a specific number of nishamas of Klal Yisrael. Okay, but his point right now is not getting into the nishamas part. This other explanation has to do with the entity of Klal Yisrael.
But this is a much nicer explanation because I'm sort of bothered by the fact that if somebody is homesick, they all of a sudden don't have a covenant with Hashem. It just didn't seem right.
Okay. Now, you know, to bring out this point more about the entity of Klal Yisrael and to show this idea of this entity that it's not just a gathering of individuals, an entity unto itself, so Reisman brings two examples to that, shows two things. There is a halacha that a carbon can be brought by two people in a partnership. However, if let's say they brought the carbon as a partnership, and then one of the partners die, so that can fall under the category of a carbon whose owner has died, and depending on what kind of carbon that is, I believe, it's going to be invalid. You have a chata shemesu ba'alei, a sin offering that the owner has died, you can't do anything with it. So, or wherever, whatever other carbon that may apply to, but if you talk about a carbon that has a partnership, two people are bringing a carbon together, one of them die, then you could run into the problem of, you know, this carbon had two owners, one of the owners dies, so that part becomes, so to speak, invalid. You can't bring it as a carbon anymore. But we know that there are carbonas tzibur, right? There are communal sacrifices, sacrifices brought by the entire Jewish people. We all give, all the Jewish people give a half a shekel to have their portion of the carbonas tzibur, right? The carbonas tzibur brought for everybody, and some people die before it's brought for them. And we don't say there's a problem here. Oh, what do you mean? It's chata shemesu ba'alei. It's a sacrifice that one of the owners died. Because it's not a question of individual owners. It's Klal Yisrael. It's an ownership of an entity. Because an ownership of an entity, that whole halacha doesn't apply. He brings this idea out also with another interesting case. He brings the following case. There was a Shaila asked, the question that was posed to the Chassam Sefer. And he brings there, it seems, a case where an entire city made a Kabbalah. An entire city accepted something upon themselves. And there came a time when there was a desire to basically try to annul that oath, to annul that shvua that was made by this community. So they asked the Chassam Sefer, how should they do it? Does the whole city have to go to annul this oath? Or could there be some kind of a representative? Or does the whole city have to go? It was something that the city as a whole accepted upon themselves. Now they're trying to annul it. So they have to, does a whole city now have to go in front of a Bezdin to be able to annul it?
Well, if someone died, that would be a kind of problem.
Excuse me?
That person who took it upon himself but then died,
yeah,
would not be able to annul it.
Well, he's not really relevant because he's gone.
Well, okay.
Okay. The Chassam Sefer said, nope. A tzibur is an entity unto its own. And therefore, even a representative of the tzibur can go ahead and do it. Now, there's a halacha that we know Erev Rosh Hashanah is accustomed to about Taras Hadarim, knowing of the vows. Anytime you make a vow and you want to not have to keep it anymore, you have to go for a hatara. You have to have it annulled. And there's specific halachas to that. Now, if I need to annul a vow, I can't send you to do it for me. You can't stand in front of a Bezdin and represent me to go ahead and annul your vows. The only time you can represent someone else when it comes to annulling a vow is your wife. Because of a principle of ishtei kegufei, your wife is like your body. You and your wife are one. So therefore, you would be able to go to the Bezdin to have your wife's vow annulled. But you can't do that for another person. One individual cannot represent another. One individual cannot represent another individual for Hataras Adam to annul vows. But here the Chassam Sefer said that's not an issue here, because we're not representing other individuals. Here, it's not individuals that need to come and to annul the vow. It's a tzibur. It's a community. It's a community that made the vow, accepted the vow. This entity of a tzibur, this entity of the community, is what accepted the vow upon themselves. And now that entity needs annulment. Well, for the entity, a representative of the entity is enough. Again, showing the difference between individuals and an entity. And therefore, because of the fact that we are talking about the entity of Klal Yisrael, so even if an individual wasn't present, but that individual eventually is going to become part of Klal Yisrael, and the covenant was made with Klal Yisrael, with that entity of Klal Yisrael, so therefore, you're part of that entity, you're included in the covenant. We don't need your personal acceptance, because it's not an individual acceptance. It's all being part of Klal Yisrael. Now, there is something regarding the period of the year, Rosh Hashanah, that we're coming in, Aseres Yemei Teshuva, that we also see a difference between an individual and a tzibur, and a community. And that's in the following. During Aseres Yemei Teshuva, we add in the Shemoneh, there are certain additions we make in the Shemoneh Esrei. So in the first brach of the Shemoneh Esrei, we add Zochreinu L'chaim, remember us for life. Melech Chafetz B'chaim, the king that desires life. Atzer Melech Chafetz B'chosvein B'sefer Achayim, and inscribers of the Book of Life, Laman Chavakim Chayim, for your sake, living God. Or for your sake, for Laman Chavakim Chayim, for your sake, life. Now, the question is asked, that we know Shemoneh Esrei has sections. The first section of Shemoneh Esrei are blessings of praise to Hashem. Then we come into the section of requests. There are not supposed to be requests in the first three brachas of the Shemoneh Esrei. The first three brachas of the Shemoneh Esrei are all supposed to be blessings of praising Hashem, not making requests. Requests start, not tachoinim. So therefore, how was Zochreinu able to be included in the first bracha of the Shemoneh Esrei, which is not supposed to be a place for requests? Now, these additions that we say in the Shemoneh Esrei, Aseres Yemei Teshuva, you don't find them in the Gemara. The Gemara doesn't talk about them. They actually were added later, the times of the Gaonim. But nonetheless, the question is, how did the Gaonim have the right to do that? It's seemingly it's not the place to do so. We know we're not supposed to make supplications during that section of the Shemoneh Esrei. So how do we say Zochreinu L'chaim? How do we ask for life? And the commentary of Tosfos answers, because it depends. An individual cannot make requests in the first three brachas. But the tzibur may. The tzibur may. For the tzibur may, when it's a request for the tzibur, when it's a request for the community, for the nation, that you're allowed to. Those kind of requests you can make even in the section of the Shemoneh Esrei that is supposed to be for praising Hashem. So Reisman brings from Rabbi Matisyo Solomon, Shlita of the Lakewood Yeshiva, that Rabbi Matisyo said, if so, then when you say Zochreinu L'chaim, when you recite that statement in the Shemoneh Esrei, if you are having yourself in mind when you say that, then you're doing the wrong thing. Then you're making a personal supplication in the part of the Shemoneh Esrei you're not allowed to. You have to have in mind, it has to be clear, your intention when saying Zechar L'chaim needs to be the Klal. It needs to be the community at large, the Jewish nation. Then it's okay to do. But if your kavan, if your intent is just about yourself and your family, you turn it into an individual request, then already you're doing the wrong thing. Then you're making a personal request and you're now in a place where you're not allowed to make a personal request. So that was just something I wanted that he shares in this whole discussion of the difference between individual and Klal Yisrael, how this comes out in our davening during Aseres Yemei Teshuva.
I have a question about community. So let's go to the town example. The example of a town that took upon
it. Yeah.
So there are 10,000 people there. And one says, I'm not interested in committing myself to that. So he's not part of the community at this point.
I don't know what this halacha is. I can't say for sure what happens in that kind of situation. Maybe if he is part of the community, he's in the shul there, and if he's generally in the community, then he may be bound by what the rest of the community does. Now, if somebody didn't move in, what happens? Somebody just moved in later. Again, there's something called minhag hamakom. I mean, you got to accept the practices of where you are. So I don't know exactly. Okay, let's continue on. We're on Pasuk Tes Vav. Yatem Yedatem, for you know, Eis Asher Yashav Nemeretz Mitzrayim, that which we dwelled in the land of Egypt, Veis Asher Avarnu Bekerav Agayim Asher Avartem, and how we passed amongst the nations through which you passed. But Tiruish, you could say of Eskilulehem, you saw their abomination, their detestable idols, Eitz Va'eben, wood and stone, kesef esav sharimoam, the silver and gold that is with them. Penyesh b'chem ish or isha, lest there be amongst you a man or a woman, a mishpacha ishevet, or a family or tribe, asher levavoi penei hayamim Hashem, whose heart is strained today from being with God, Hashem Elokein, with being Hashem our God, with Hashem our God, lelechas la'avodes Elohei ha'goyim ha'heim, to go and to worship the gods of those nations. Penyesh b'chem, lest there be amongst you shayresh arut, peira that is producing reish v'lana, these kinds of bitter plants. V'hayah b'shavah yisdibre ala hazais, and it'll be when he hears the words of this Allah, of this curse, of this oath that Hashem made, that, you know, all the punishments that were before the Jewish people as a nation, if they go and worship idols. V'sbareich b'lavavah, and it shall be when he hears the words of this oath, of this curse, and he will bless himself in his heart, saying, "Shalom yali, there will be peace for me." Although I go, basically, I walk as my heart sees fit. Thereby adding the water upon the thirsty. Then what it means is like this. You've been exposed to idol worship, and perhaps you're going to start straying and say to yourself that although I just heard these curses and all the terrible things that will happen to the Jewish people if they worship idols, he says to himself, "Meh, I'll be all right. Shalom yali, it'll be peaceful for me, although b'shrirus libi aleich, I go according to what my heart sees fit." By doing though, you now add the Rava, which they say the wat, which they translate as the warded upon the thirsty, which Rashi says means a person with that attitude who clearly is intentional in what they're doing. By being this way, they could actually now create a situation where the sins that they did, the watered down sins, so to speak, which were unintentional, right? Now, adding the water upon the thirsty, now they can be held responsible. They'll be punished even for their unintentional acts, with now becoming so intentional. Okay? Hashem will not forgive him, because then Hashem's anger and zealousness will come against that man. And the entire curse written in this book will rest upon him. Umach Hashem, Hashem will wipe out his name from below the heavens. Okay? So the Torah warns the individual, the tribe, the family, the things that they can follow whatever their heart sees fit to do and get away with it. The Torah warns, you're not going to get away with it. Hashem, you're going to arouse the anger of Hashem, and all the curses mentioned until now will rest upon you. The Meshech Chachma has a very interesting explanation to this pasuk, which he calls it drush, calls it homiletic, and it's homiletic. It's not the simple explanation to the pasuk, but it's a very interesting approach. And he starts out saying like this: there is a sifri that takes the following pasuk. There's a pasuk that says V'sartem min haderech, you shall stray from the path, lolechas la'avoid Elohim achirim, to go and to worship other gods. You shall stray from the path to go and serve other gods. So the Sifri says, Sifri, the form of Medrash says, Kevin shesartem min haderech, once you stray from the path, shuvatem oivdim, then it's inevitable that you're going to worship. There's a path that the Pasuk is saying, if you stray from the path, then you're going to be lost. Now, what's the path exactly? What path are we referring to that we say, once you stray from that path, you're a goner. Once you stray from that path, you're for sure going to worship idols. What does that mean? So he says it means like this. Yesh anoshim asher oimrim. There are those people who have the following approach to serving God. And they say like this. Basically, what's the big deal of coming close to Hashem? Is it anything special if you keep your eyes closed, meaning don't look where you're not supposed to look, and you control your lust, and you make sure to learn a lot of Torah, and daven a lot, and to be very involved in prayer and praising Hashem, and by that, cling to Hashem. Meaning, you know, in Yiddish you say, what's the kunz? What's the trick? What's the big trick, right? Being close to Hashem if you study Torah and you daven and you don't look where you're not supposed to look and you don't go where you're not supposed to go and then you're connected to God. You know, what's so special about that? That's the easy way of doing it. Rather, Elias Ari Berechavis, the Mishmakim, hang out in the streets. Go out there in the world. Get into the streets, into the markets. And seclude yourself with women that it's forbidden for you to be involved with. And basically, you know, kind of go and follow where your heart takes you. Don't do anything wrong, though. But you are going to go ahead and you're going to restrain yourself. You're going to hold yourself back. You're controlling yourself with the fear of God that is like a burning fire in your heart. Az yala malad ein misbar. Now we're talking about growing. Now we're talking about growing. Go ahead. You know, basically, kind of, you know, go right up to the, you know, go, how do we say it? Test yourself. But like, you know, live on the edge, right? Live on the edge, right? Don't do anything wrong, but live on the edge, kind of put yourself in danger, hold yourself back. That's really getting close to God. That's real growing. You go out and you still learn a whole day, and you daven a whole day, and you stay safe, and you don't look where you're not supposed to look, and you don't get involved with the people you're not supposed to be involved with.
Too easy.
Big deal. What's that? You call that being close to Hashem? You want to be close to Hashem? Put yourself in a tough situation and practice the self-control. Restrain yourself. That's the way to grow. And that, says the Meshech Chachma, the Pasuk, on that said, that's what our Pasuk is coming to go against. Lazar Ma'akosav. For this, the Pasuk says, Penyesh Bachem, perhaps there is a person. What does the person say? Shalom Yeli. He wants to say, again, this is Drush, it's homiletic, but he says, Shalom means peace will be to me. Pirish, a masai asig rima maila v'tachlis shalemas Yisraeli. You know, the word peace is related to the word shalom, to be complete. So the person says, shalom yali, I want to reach the highest level of shalemas. I want to reach the highest level that a Jew can come, the highest level of perfection, of completeness that a Jew can come to. So the person is saying, shalom yali, I want shalom. I want to be at the highest level of shalemas, of perfection. And I'll do that by following wherever my heart sees fit to go. Right? Build up the lust. And still, and then by going in and restraining myself, I'll come to the point of the benefit of adding the watered to the thirsty. Pirish. You She says like this: we know there are certain things that are forbidden that we don't necessarily have a desire for. You know, it comes to a point of time, right? You know, that and should a point of time for many people, you know, there is really no desire for pork. It's just it's not in the cards. It's just completely irrelevant. Okay? And the word Nika use is, I'm not sure if he means to say this actually or as much as what this person is saying. You know, so if you come to a point of time, let me ask you, come to a point, right, where you don't have a desire for anything. So if I don't, so does that mean that, you know, so at that point, right, like, this is irrelevant to me, you know? Or let's say, I've never had any kind of desire for pork, but there are people like that. They've never been challenged by it, okay? Never been challenged by it, okay? So does that mean that basically, you know, this prohibition was irrelevant for you and you're not going to get any kind of reward for staying away from it because, you know, it's never a challenge for you? Now, there is discussion about that. And discussion about that is the fact that you've brought yourself or you keep yourself at a level where it's not something that is desirable to you. That's also something. But again, so I don't know if he means to say that there is less reward for that, or this person's philosophy is, look, if I can build up my desire for something and control it, then I can actually take those things that were not a desire for me, that were not a challenge to me, which therefore I wouldn't get rewarded for, but now that I create a challenge, I get rewarded for that too. I can bring that into the, you know? I'll walk into a restaurant and I'll sit there and I'll watch that very good looking, you know, piece of a chop, you know, or ribs that, you know, look really good, and, you know, and I'll smell it and I'll build it up, and the kinds of things that I never would have been rewarded for, now I'll be rewarded because I created the desire, I had the desire, but I controlled it. So the pasuk says to that person, "Lo yaveh Hashem sleach lei." You're not. It's Hashem is not going to forgive you for that, because it's not going to happen. Because it just doesn't happen. To think that you'll be able to play games with your passion, your desires, and control it, and decide that's how I want to grow with Hashem. Hashem says unacceptable, and it's unacceptable. The way I understand it is because, as the Medrash says, if you go off the path. Right, the path is the path of the path of Torah is the path in which I do not expose myself to these challenges. But if I go off that path, it's not exposing myself. Then it's inevitable. Eventually, you're going to fail. Eventually, you're just going to fall into those things and actually perform those sins.
But is the premise correct though?
What?
That if I, for example, never care about these things,
I don't know. I mean, the premise that if you never cared, yeah, that's why I said I don't know, because the wording he brings is, he says the wording is things that a person is basically disgusted by. The ein la adam schar la prisha, and a person doesn't get rewarded for separating yourself from them. I don't know. That's why I said I don't know if he means that as a fact that there is no reward for that. As I said before, maybe the word is the fact that you don't. By keeping what the Torah wants, you don't put yourself in that situation. So because you're not allowing yourself to come into that situation that you get rewarded for, maybe he means not as much reward, or maybe it's what that's what this guy is trying to claim. That's a different story.
Yeah.
That's a whole different story. Now, okay, so this Meshech Chachma, so it's a very interesting idea, and it's a very interesting way of trying to interpret the Psukim. Sounds a bit extreme, right? Sounds a bit extreme. You know, I'll put myself, I'll go right up to the edge, and I'll take it in, I'll look at it, but I'm going to hold myself back. Now, that seems to be, you know, seems a bit extreme. Not to say there weren't people who tried to believe it, who apparently did believe in that. But I think we could actually, you know, take it on a little bit of a lower level, and that is that the point of the Meshech Chachma is that even if you don't go as far as what he's saying, at the end of the day, we're sometimes not very careful with that. We're sometimes not careful with these kind of things. We sometimes do allow ourselves to be exposed to certain things. And we're not exposing ourselves with the intention of saying, oh, I'm going to expose myself and I'll control myself. No, we're not doing that. We're not doing it intentionally to the sense of, you know, I'll purposely expose myself so that I'll arouse my desires and control it. But we do expose ourselves to things. And we kind of, you know, we excuse ourselves that, well, you know, it's not so bad, it's not going to affect us. Maybe we do use this rational of saying, well, you know, if you're never exposed, you know, then when you become exposed, you fall on your face, you know. If you're somewhat exposed, it won't be as harsh to you, you know. So if you expose yourself a little bit, you know, it'll kind of fortify you so that if you ever are really exposed, you won't, you know, really fall on your face with it. You know, we do tend to make this argument at some level in the sense that we make an argument that it's okay if we expose ourselves or our children to certain things because either, well, it won't really affect us. Well, maybe it's not so bad for them to be exposed so that they'll, by being exposed, they won't be as surprised or shocked when they do become more exposed possibly to this, you know. We find certain excuses to allow ourselves or children to expose to things. And the point of what we're trying to say here is that it's that no, there's not that that's not acceptable. It's not acceptable to go ahead and expose yourself or your children to things with this excuse, not again as extreme as what he's saying, but with the idea of, well, you know, either it's not so bad, or, you know, maybe it's a little bit healthy to be exposed a little bit so that you'll be used to it. It won't surprise you so much, it won't be such a shock, you know, people get exposed to things, you know, you live in the world, you're going to get exposed to things. Well, you know, if you've never seen such a thing, it really has a strong impression upon you. If you're a little bit exposed, it won't be as harsh. There are tendencies to think that way. So even if we don't go as far as the case of the Meshech Chachma, the idea is the same, that if you start straying from the path and you say to yourself, it's okay to be somewhat exposed, you're really putting yourself into big danger. And of course, sometimes, you know, we are going to be exposed. It's inevitable we're going to be exposed to things for whatever reason it may be. But it doesn't mean that we therefore become lax and allow ourselves to be exposed when not necessary. Because when we do stray from that path of protecting ourselves and our children from being exposed to sin, we are actually now putting ourselves and our children into the danger of being sucked in to the actual problem, to the actual sin itself. Okay. The next thing I want to do, it's a double parsha this week. So it's Parshas Vayelech. Take a look on page 1094. Moshe called Yehoshua. Vayemra Elov, and he said to him, "La'enai call Yisrael, in front of all of Israel, Chazak v'yamatz, be strong, be courageous, ki ata tava yasa amazeh, for you will enter with this nation, Ela aris to the land, asher nishba Hashem la'avaysam l'seis lahem, that Hashem has sworn to their fathers to give to them, v'atatan chaleno oisam, and you shall make them inherit, take over, and you shall cause them to take the land." So Moshe tells Yeshua, Chazak v'amatz, be strong, be courageous. Okay. Now, we understand Moshe telling Yeshua, be strong, be courageous, because he's going to lead the Jewish people into the land of Israel. He's going to have to conquer the land. He's going to have to fight a war with mighty nations. He's going to have to deal with the leadership of the Jewish people. Chazak v'amatz, be strong, be courageous. The Yalkut Shemaini, which is a compilation of Midrashim, in Sefer Hosea of Treyaser, says the following. There's a pasuk in Hosea, Ki na Yisrael v'ayavoy. Hashem refers, the prophet refers to the Jewish people as Ki na Yisrael v'ayavoy. Yisrael, Israel, is the lad, the young child, and the loved one of Hashem. Zeh sha'amar ha'kasev. This is what the pasuk means, this pasuk we just read. Vayomer Elov le'enei kol Yisrael chazak v'ematz. Moshe said to Yeshua, be strong, be courageous. Omar Moshe. Moshe was saying to Yeshua, when he said, be strong and be courageous, Am zeh shani moiser lach. This nation that I'm giving over to you, Adayin gediyim heim. They're still kids. Adayin tinoikes heim. They're still very young. Al takber aleihem. Don't become angry at them. Don't be harsh with them. Amasha heim oisim, for what they do. Shaf ribayinam lehikber aleihem. Amasha asu. For even their master isn't harsh with them for what they've done. Shenemar, as the pasuk says, Hinai Yisrael v'ayavai. Israel, the Jewish nation, is the child and the loved one of Hashem. From Egypt, I called him my son. There's a concept that even after everything the Jewish people have done, Hashem still calls them my child. Which means that after everything they've done, he still isn't as harsh with them as you'd expect. Chazak ve'amatz, when Moshe said Yeshua, be strong and be courageous, means really the Jewish people are a young nation. They're like children. And treat them as Hashem would have, as Hashem does. Hashem hasn't been harsh with them, although he could have been harsher with them. And so too, when you lead them like children. Don't be overly harsh with them. You have to realize they still need to be developed. They still need to grow. They still need to be developed. Now, if the Medrash brings down this message, then, you know, number one, it's not just a message for Yeshua. It's a message for all generations, or else it wouldn't be in the Navi. It's for all generations. But let's, like, understand now. Yeshua is being told, Chazak, you must be strong and be courageous. Basically, according to this Medrash, what is he being told to be? Patient. He's being told to be patient and understanding. The Jewish people, they're like children. You can't be overly harsh. You've got to be patient and understanding. So chazak v'amatz, be strong and courageous, means be patient and understanding. Would you have connected strength and courage to patience and understanding? Offhand, you probably wouldn't have. But that's what the Medrash is doing. The Medrash is saying the strength and the courage that Hashem tells you, that Moshe tells Yeshua to have, is in his patience and tolerance and understanding for the Jewish people.
Like a child.
And that patience and tolerance and understanding takes strength. It means it takes a strength of self-control, self-restraint. And it takes courage. What do you think it means to take courage? What do you mean? What do you have to be patient and understanding takes courage? I'm going to say strength means that there's an inner strength, a self-control that you have to have. What does it mean, courage?
To be confident that eventually they will do the right thing.
So to be confident that they'll do the right thing, to be confident in what you're doing,
right.
To be confident that your patience is not weakness,
right.
But on the contrary, it's courage. Be courageous. Know that this is a strength that is a strength that you, the same way you have to be courageous against, you know, your enemy, right, in a war, you have to be courageous in dealing with people, right? Not to be intimidated, not to be afraid, right? And even in being patient, right? Anybody who deals with children or with students knows that sometimes the tolerance, the patience for the student needs a certain courage in the sense of, I mean, the way I understand it, a sense of courage of you know, you got to show that student that, you know, I'm not afraid of you. And I'm not afraid of you even when I'm patient, even when I'm tolerant. I'm not just not afraid of you when I punish you. I am confident in myself, and I feel strong and confident right in what I'm doing, even when I'm, so to speak, not reacting in a harsh way. You know, you think that sometimes you got to show the student who's boss, but sometimes on the contrary, you want to show who's boss. You show them by boss by being tolerant, by being understanding, by showing them that I'm confident with myself. I know who I am, and you know, you're not going to rattle me. And in very many levels, that has a lot to do with dealing with students, dealing with children. There's a strength to be patient, to take strength, and a certain courage to be able to feel that I don't have to show my power. I don't have to show that I'm in control of the situation by losing my cool, by losing my patience. But rather, I can be patient, I can be tolerant, be understanding. And it'll take a certain courage. It'll take a certain degree of standing up to that child, to that student. and not be afraid that being tolerant and understanding is going to put you at a disadvantage. There is a beautiful story with Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky that during World War I, when he was basically a student in Slabodka Yeshiva and he had to run away because of the war, he found himself in a certain town. And he needed to support himself. So he became the local malamed. He became the local teacher for the children. And the children were coming back home and telling their parents that this new Rebbe, he's kind of weird. He's kind of different. You know that whip that the Rebbe usually uses to kind of keep us in control? He doesn't use it. Right? He kind of just threw it by the garbage. And then you know what else he did? He gave us recess. He let us take a break for 10 minutes. And this was like, what's going on with this? Who is this newfangled teacher? This young new teacher. What's going on with him? So they went to the local Rav, and they presented the situation. And the Rav pointed to a picture on the wall. And the picture on the wall was a picture of Rav Yitzchak Yochanan Spector. He was a Rav of Kovna, and he was the recognized leader of Lithuanian Jewry. And he was the leader, he was the gadol, he was the great, he was a Torah giant, that people, his picture was up in people's homes. He was there, he was a leader of Lithuanian Jewry at the time. So he pointed a picture and he said, you see the picture of the Kovna Tzaddik? The Kovna Tzaddik, his picture is in all Jewish homes. One day, this young man's, his picture will be up in Jewish homes. And that was Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky's atzal. I think in that story, there's a certain courage that he was ready to kind of stand up to the situation. And that he felt that the patience and the tolerance is what's going to give him his success with the students. And that courage to basically, not be afraid of what other people are going to say, to be tolerant and to be more tolerant and less harsh. In a more general way, I think as what we said before, there's clearly a strength to be tolerant, a certain self-control that you need to be patient. There's a certain courage not to feel you're diminished in any way by being that way. And that's what Moshe was saying to Yeshua. Chazak v'emat, that's after the Jewish people. And if this is again a message in the Navi, then it's got to apply for all generations. That when we lead, whoever we're leading, we have to realize these are Hashem's children. As the pasuk says, "Chinar Yisrael Vayevay." It's the Bnei Shalom's children. If they're children, then their Bnei Shalom is not harsh with them. You shouldn't be harsh with them, and be strong and courageous to be patient and to be tolerant and understanding. Apparently, we did not get up to the rest of the message.